So I'm Peter Taylor. If you want to follow up,
here's my, there's a lot of things on my website. You can spend a lot of time getting lost. So here's the title, Trouble by Heterogeneity, Opportunities for Fresh Views on Longstanding and Recent Issues in Biology and Biomedicine. So I'm troubled by heterogeneity. I had no idea what kind of mix my audience is going to be. Here we are in a theoretical biology program, but I know there are philosophers of science and historians and sociologists. Maybe there's some life sciences and policymakers. So what I tried to do is make the talk, there to be something in the talk for each of these. And if we don't have any, if we don't have policymakers, for example, we have an ethicist, you know, it's getting close to policy. Then you just tolerate the things that are out of your domain. But what I hope is that by giving each field something, you'll take up the larger challenge of stretching it into the center of the things your field deals with. But I think by the end you'll see, or in discussion we can talk about it, the points about heterogeneity are going to be challenging to each of these areas. So a little bit of prologue is that although I've been using the word heterogeneity in grant applications and stuff more recently, I realize in retrospect I've been giving people trouble. In particular, I worked a lot more in environmental studies with heterogeneity for quite a while. So just last week, in a course about environment, science, and society, 3 weeks ago, I used this example where you've got two islands and you've got a population growth rate. Here's the present. And I say to students, well, what more do you want to know, and what are you going to do with that knowledge? And usually students are like home in on the idea that, well, if this keeps on going, the islands are going to fill up and the people should either reduce their consumption per person or should reduce their population growth. But then I say, look, there's something I forgot to tell you about the islands. This one has an equal land distribution, and this one, everything else is the same, but this one has 70% of the people living on 2% of the land and 2% on the 60% of the land, and the middle's in the middle. Now what would you do? And as a teaching exercise, I would say, now you're going to be the rich people, you're going to be the middle people, and you're going to be the poor. And very quickly, they're not talking about contraception and resource consumption. These are talking about revolution or guns, and these are talking about protecting themselves from guns, and these are talking about history, like these people's grandparents took the land away from you, and these people are talking about how to prevent it becoming violent, how to make some new industries so people no longer need to live off the land. All of a sudden, they've rediscovered all sorts of dynamics that actually happen in the real world based on not just inequality, but dynamic relationships between unequal units. And that's part of what happens when you start to pay attention to this area I'm calling heterogeneity, which is a heterogeneous field in itself. But given that there's no island like this in the real world, and there's no place like this in the real world, we always start here. Not that you'd know that if you talk to neo-Malthusians or people who promote population control, but this is always already where we begin. And this was the land distribution of Nicaragua and El Salvador in the late 1970s, when one country had a revolution and the other country had a stalled, a civil war, protracted civil war. So I say, here's the theme that comes out of the little case study which they've experienced. The analysis and the implications change qualitatively if uniform units, that's like, we're all one unit of population, get changed by unequal units that are subject to further differentiation, dynamic relations which change their relation as a result of their linked dynamics. So I've been using this example for perhaps 20 years. So clearly I've been trying to trouble people with heterogeneity. And in fact, in my book, Unruly Complexity, which I bought some shameless commerce, we call it, bought some copies for 15 euros if anyone wants one. Unruly Complexity. So the subtitle is Ecology, Interpretation, Engagement. So in all these areas, both, ecology, the science and the philosophy of the science, and
theoretical ecology and also science and technology studies, history and sociology of science, and also the engagement, the bringing these perspectives back into the science, I call it teaching here. I have these three aspects of what I call unruly complexity are central, are key themes.
Well, don't try to read it while I'm talking, but there it is. It's a, so here, the first one, heterogeneous components, is in there, built up over time. This is the developmental side of myself, though I've come a distance from when I was a fan of Brian Goodwin. I've paid more attention to this the heterogeneity now than I did when I was a Goodwinian, and the embeddedness in wider dynamics. So that's my prologue. I've been thinking about these things for a lot longer. But this unruly complexity in ecology led me to say, look, I want to, instead of thinking about field work, I want to get closer to home. And I started to look at the equivalent complexities in what I'm calling biosocial development. You know, the way biological and social factors build up over microfamily dynamics, build up over people's lifetimes, and particularly the field of social epidemiology. But as I started to get acquainted with different research traditions that interested me, and I found that there was a unifying critical theme, which was that people were, either I was troubled by heterogeneity that wasn't examined, or I was interested in the ways people were untroubled by heterogeneity when I would think they might need to be. And so that's what this talk's about. So let me illustrate what it means to be troubled or untroubled by heterogeneity with some examples. So I said in the abstract, the first example would be looking at nature-nurture debates, twin studies. Heritability is a concept that's central to those studies. So we'll look in a second about what heterogeneity is. But how can you apply these, what people find out about the heritability of human traits, if underlying heterogeneity is possible? So that's my question, and now I'm going to motivate that question. And I want to say in advance, it's a question that other people haven't asked, and I think it's simple and profound. So first of all, we have to define heritability. So people make claims like heritability of IQ test scores is 60 to 80%. So what could that mean? And it certainly doesn't mean that IQ has a gene and that gene gets passed on. You know, that colloquial idea that something is heritable means it's passed on from parent to offspring through the germline. That's not what this heritability means. Heritability is a technical concept meaning something different. So if it's 60%, could it mean that genes have more influence on IQ than environment? Well, here in a context where you're probably all familiar with development, that kind of statement doesn't mean anything. You know, sort of which part of your body is the genes part and which is environment. You know, there's no place where you can pull these things apart. You know, if you don't have an environment, you don't grow at all. If you don't have genes, you don't grow at all. So could it mean that changing genes has more influence on IQ than changing environments? Well, that's it's closer, but that depends on which genes you imagine changing, and you don't know what genes are involved in IQ. And there's a myriad of environmental factors. What it actually means is something that's got nothing really to do with the genes or the environmental factors. It's got to do with the trait that's observed. The IQ is the trait. So the variation among the means of genetically defined varieties of whatever, well, in this case, the human organism, average across all locations, all families, if it's humans that they grow up in, is greater than the variation of the means of locations for that trait that you're concerned with, average over all varieties. That's a very long-winded statement, but that's what it means. So what's underlying heterogeneity means? It means the genetic and environmental factors underlying the trait. See, in this last definition, we didn't we weren't referring to any specific genetic or environmental factors, is heterogeneous. So let me illustrate that with a diagram. So in humans, you often study, estimate their heritability through twin studies. So you compare these, how similar dizygotic twins are, fraternal twins, non-identical twins. So you see that little bracket is larger than this bracket, which is the monozygotic twins. So in this study, we imagine there are eight twin pairs, and they're grown in eight locations or eight families. So you see each, that one's in that family, and that one's in another, and so on. Don't worry about this yet. And you see that, on average, these monozygotic twins are more similar, these little, they're closer together than these dizygotic twins. Now, monozygotic twins share all their genes, and the dizygotic twins don't share all their genes. So it makes sense that if these are more similar than these, then they're more similar because they share more genes. And you can put that on a quantitative, there's, you know, there are formulas, and you can make that quantitative and come up with these figures of 60 to 80%. But what's interesting and important is there's nothing in that method that tells you that the genes and the environmental factors involved, you know, here's a lot of pairs of alleles, here's a sequence of environmental factors, that make this monozygotic twins similar is the same set of genes that make this monozygotic twin similar. There could be what I call an underlying heterogeneity. These ones could still be similar because they share lots of genes. These ones could still be similar because they share lots of genes. I'm not denying that, but I'm just saying there's nothing to say that the genes could be the same. And to be really perverse, it could actually be, I could give you a data set and you could analyze it. And then I could tell you the data set for body length. And then I could tell you that this twin pair were humans, this was sorghum plants, this was pythons, and this was, baboons or something like that. There's nothing in the method that says they even have to be the same kingdom, let alone phyla species, going down to species. So the method doesn't need to know that, and therefore it can't know that. So that's troubling. That's potentially troubling, because what can you do with the knowledge of human heterogeneity, if underlying heterogeneity is possible? Now, I'm not saying every trait is necessarily can be arrived at by different sequences, but we're pretty sure that, you know, the common traits that people do heritability of, like height, are, you know, some people grow quickly early, some people grow they're longer up to their waist than others, and so on. So we know height is not something arrived at by some simple uniform process. And so what could you do with this knowledge? Well, I think I've summarized a set of things I've thought about. Maybe you've got some other things. One is to just forget about heritability estimates and do some other kinds of research, which these days people do. Now they're able to assay people's certain genes, or at least SNPs and so on, and so you can just throw it away. The next thing you could do is say, well, if something's highly heritable in this way, then maybe it's a good candidate for molecular research, so let's go and do the molecular research and find out about the factors, and maybe some of the times it'll be, a search will be a bust, a useless, because the trait will have underlying heterogeneity. You know, different families, different organisms will have got that trait by different means. But sometimes you'll hit the jackpot and you'll get those underlying factors. So we could do that, as long as we're aware that a lot of the time, or some of the time, or some unknown fraction of the time, it's not going to be a fruitful search. Another thing you could do, though, is restrict your attention to variation within a set of relatives. So if we go back to this picture before, so now we're just going to look at these ones, or these relatives of these ones. And so in that case, they probably, you know, if one twin
gets, if we've found that the heritability of diabetes 1 is reasonably high, and one twin gets diabetes, it would tell the other one, you know, you're pretty much, you know, you've got a much stronger chance of getting it yourself. And so that would be a warning to them. They could prepare for it, or they could do some things to prevent its onset. But even giving that example is assuming that there's already some other factors involved, because otherwise they would get it at the same time in their life. There'd be no chance to be warned. But still, it is true that people do research on particular families with strong traits, you know, like in the research on the so-called warrior gene on MAOA. There's some Dutch family, I don't actually know the details, but some Dutch family that have a very high frequency of this allele and a very high frequency of the behavior. So they work out some genetics that deals with that family, and then they hope, maybe, that having worked it out in one case, they can then extrapolate to another case, or at least get some insight into the underlying biology that might help them in cases that are different. We could do this thing, which is actually the traditional thing. You know, people, even before they knew what DNA was, had any idea of the material basis, much of the material basis of genes. They were just getting, in the early part of the century, getting an idea about chromosomes and so on. They were already calculating heritabilities. And they were just doing it by, you know, in agriculture and lab breeding, by looking at the variation of the trait. And so if it's highly heritable and you then select it, you're confident that you'll get a good response. If it's not highly heritable and you select it, you're not confident you'll get a good response. But what's interesting to me about agricultural laboratory breeding is that if they predict a good result and then they don't get a good result, it's okay, they just flush the flies down the... It doesn't matter. In humans, you can't just breed people and you can't flush them away if they don't achieve the IQ score you hope for. And the last thing you could do is restrict the range of varieties or locations. So there are people who have looked at heritability of IQ score and discovered that if you just restrict your attention to poor people, it doesn't turn out to be quite so high. So they're then suggesting that the data is skewed by having a particular class that it's been looking at. And they then go on and explain why they think that is about the way poor people don't achieve their abilities and so on. But that's not the important point here. So in a way, in human research, you can't do this. You can only do this sort of by subdividing the data. You can do this a little bit. You can do this if you open to an unknown fraction of your research programs turning out to give you no result, and of course you can do this, which is not using human heritability. So there's a lot of limitations, so it ought to be more troubling. And the flip side of it is that you can make it work to the extent that you can control your subject material, either control it by we're only looking at specific locations or specific subsections of the population, going down to even sets of relatives. And that theme about controlling populations was in my abstract and will come back again. So, okay, underlying heterogeneity is not yet recognized as significant, and the Biological Theory was the first journal that published it, but it hasn't my work on it, but it's not yet receiving a huge amount of attention, so that's part of the sociology of science. But what it did to me, as I said, something that is fairly simple to explain, and but it's been overlooked for now almost a century. A heuristic for me is there must be some deeper social, historical, and also conceptual roots to this blindness. And so I started to, you know, explore that, try to encourage other people to explore it. And it also then, reciprocally, once you start to open this up, it gives opportunities. I believe it's worth exploring because it gives opportunities for fresh views on long-standing issues like the significance of heritability in human areas,
and also some more recent ones. So, Verna, I didn't look at the time when I started, and I don't know what our time is. I just want to.
I have no watch. I don't know.
Well, okay. I'll just go until I'll keep on going. So, okay, so conceptual roots. So this is kind of like for the philosophers of science here, but also others might start to think about it in terms of common language.
So I'm thinking there's a move that needs to be made from typological thinking to recognizing underlying heterogeneity, and I'm suggesting that even though no one wants to believe they do typological thinking, we've still got a lot of residues in our methods, ironically and particularly in statistics. So typological thinking would be noticing that the mean of group A, where it lives, is different from the mean of group B, and then you start to look at for the environmental or genetic factors, or one or both, that explain that difference.
Well, we know that means are means of a range.
So the range in the typological view, we recognize as a range, but we kind of discount it. Or we only include it to the extent that we say, is the variation sufficiently big that this difference between means is not statistically significant? And if the variation is not so big, we say, okay, so there's a significant difference between means, and we go back to explaining that.
That's a lot of social science to be. Now, we could actually be a little bit more nuanced. Instead of just explaining that, we could also then secondarily explain this. And that tends to happen there. I'm using the word tend. When people talk about, on average, men are taller than women, they're saying, you know, there's a men group and a women group. And then they're saying, but there's a range of heights among women, and they start to try to look at the hormonal stuff or the way they developed among women. So they make a first cut and a second cut. But there's really nothing in the world that says you have to cut it that way. We could alternatively just accept that there's a spread of values for group A in location A and a spread of values for group B in location B, where location to me is this generic term for the way it gets brought up. And you might say, well, women are growing up in the same city of Vienna as the men growing up, but they're not. We can't just assume that they're actually growing up in the same location, that they get fed the same food or in the same exercise regimes and so on. So I just keep that agnostic, keep that open. And once you go that way, we could say it's quite possible that there are some women in the range of women that share more of the underlying genetic and environmental factors. That's what these graphs are supposed to indicate. You know, here are the factors going into a woman here and a particular woman here, other factors going into a particular man. It's quite possible that some women share more factors with some men than those men share with other men and those women share with other women. There's nothing about the world where men and women, where it's usually not 100%, able for us to distinguish between men and women, but there, you know, this is not saying, this idea of underlying heterogeneity is not saying we can't divide the world into men and women in some ambiguous cases, but it's saying that the factors that led to the woman's height, she may share more with some men than she shares with women. And the problem is, once you start to pay attention to underlying heterogeneity, you say, but how can I expose those factors? Surely it's better to start by recognizing that there are women and men, and now I just look at the women, and you know, so you focus in on something. This is a methodological challenge, and people saying, look, you're asking for too much information, you're asking for some sort of God's eye view of the world where you can see everything underneath the surfaces, are kind of like resisting. So there's an interesting tussle there. Okay, so what I'm finding leads me to the thesis that I put in the abstract, which is that the research and the application of the knowledge are untroubled by heterogeneity. In other words, they can go back and do this kind of stuff. To the extent that the populations are well controlled, but control can be established and maintained only with considerable effort and social infrastructure. And that which I'm going to illustrate in a second. And that social fact, not a conceptual or a scientific methodological fact, then gives opportunities for participation, for getting involved, engaged with the complexity in different ways. So all those themes will emerge, I hope, by the time I finish. Okay, yeah, so that's what I just, you know, this connection between heterogeneity, control, infrastructure, and participation is what I think a lot about these days and encourage more people to think about. So, okay, so an example which I brought up in the discussion at KLI the other day, and now I have to think about it more, but is the fluoridation of water supplies. So in the United States, the way fluoridation is very common, and the cartoon version of the history is that people noticed that cavities in people in areas where there was a naturally high level of fluoride in the water were much less than those where there wasn't the natural level. So they knew that there was variation in the amount of dental cavities. And they knew there was variation in the amount of tooth modeling people got, but they could just focus on this environmental factor, more fluoride, and say, therefore, we should put fluoride in these people's water as well. And there's some resistance, there are places where it hasn't happened, but that was enough for them for it to become quite widespread in the United States. Now, for them to be able to do that, they have to control the population, which they're able to do by being able to have water supplies where the water is coming through from a certain source and be able to put the fluoride in at that place. The alternative might have been to give everyone fluoride tablets and ask them to take it, but the policymakers, health policymakers, would say, but people don't take their tablets, or we can't show they take their tablets, or they might take too many. This way we know exactly how much they're getting in their water if they're drinking water. So for them it was, and they were also able to neutralize the resistance of people who said, I don't want someone putting things in my water, or, you know, I get the mottled teeth, this isn't good for me. They're able to like discount those people. So infrastructure and control enabled them not to pay attention to heterogeneity, which in this case is just a simple form of heterogeneity, which is the variation around the type or the mean. But if you then took this same data and said, this is the IQ test score of whites in America, and this is the IQ score of African Americans, and there's a distinct difference, and then said, let's look for environmental factors and genetic factors, there'd be a lot more people who'd be troubled. They would say, but hold on, there are many African Americans who score much higher than many whites. This is even an exaggerated difference. But so why are we going to treat these African Americans as if they're here and these whites as if they're there? You know, they don't want a world like that. They want a world where you're paying attention to the underlying heterogeneity. That sounds good. Though, at the same time, in order to do their work, they have to use data. And the data is collected on IQ test scores, labeled by whether you're African American or white. You know, they don't have the data on all sorts of other characteristics. And it gets even more complicated because the people's identification about on the census about whether they're African American has changed over time, and even changes from one context to another. And if you start talking about this idea that people are very different, you'll feed into what is a right-wing thing in the United States, which says, yeah, we should all be race blind, we've got beyond race, which is a way to make sure we have no affirmative action, nothing that that tries to deal with past injustices. The sociological thing of paying attention to heterogeneity is there's tensions in there that aren't simply resolved. Okay, so more opportunities for paying attention to heterogeneity. I don't know whether some of you came across this work, this couple Caspi and Moffat. In 2002, they published two articles in Science, and various people were quite jealous of their productivity, and they are quite hot, this couple. But this
paper is basically about, you can see that there's a genotype and there's an environment or a social condition. So there's an interaction between the two.
And this graph, this is the one I said, this on my computer comes up with just showing this.
So forget about the rest of this. I cropped it and now it's like, it's one of these things where you get to look behind PDFs. Anyway, so this graph here, this is completely new to me, I don't understand. What it's showing is that, well, I can summarize it in a table. Yes, this table came out right. So what they find out is if you've got this MAOA gene, monoamine oxidized version A, and you've got it at low levels, and you had severe childhood maltreatment, you've got a very high chance of being an antisocial on various different measures they do of antisocial. If you had no childhood maltreatment, or just only probably, maybe, and you have the low MOA, you don't, there's no issue. And if you had high MOA and this, there's no issue. And if you had high MOA and your severe maltreatment, you still don't end up antisocial. So people might even say high MOA is protective against maltreatment. Caspi and Moffat and their authors conclude that this result, that there's an interaction between the measurable genetic factor and the social treatment, might suggest that we have prophylactic, we boost anyone's MOAO by some drug. They could imagine some future. So everyone just gets shifted across to here, and therefore you're all resistant to maltreatment. I don't know if any of you are sitting there saying, but couldn't you just say, let's try to reduce severe maltreatment down to here, and then we don't have any problem either. Somehow they don't conclude that at the end of their paper. And at first, that's a quick sort of like rejoinder to them, because in fact, giving everyone prophylactic, or giving all the people who have low MOA, screening them and then giving them this thing and keeping them on it for the rest of their life, is like this fluoride tablet problem. You could put it in the water supply, maybe, but then you'd be doing it for all these people too. But doing this is pretty hard too. You have to have a whole lot of social workers, and you have to be monitoring and surveillance. So it's not actually an easy thing. You know, conceptually, in this diagram, it's easy to go like this, but in practice, it requires a lot of infrastructure too.
That's not my main sort of objection to their work, though it's the first one. My main objection is if we go back to this graph,
what you see here is some error bars. So what we had in that table was just the means.
So what that means is that there's variation around these characteristics, and if this kind of works,
these are two possible cutoff points. And what I mean by cutoffs, if you say, okay, it's only above this high red line that we really consider people as antisocial, that are like real problems that we want to get rid of, we want to try to avoid. So that means, and this is the MAOA level, and this is the different, this is maltreatment, and this is probable, and this is low, so there are three categories. That would mean, because of the variation, that you're going to miss out on there's going to be some people who have low MOA, and now I'm going to get tired. You're going to misclassify, is my point, but I've got to just bear with me while I try to get it right. Oh, okay, that's right. If you just screen for among children, people with low MOA, you're going to miss some of the people with high MOA, who, this is just a one standard deviation, who would have ended up here, would end up antisocial. You're going to focus on these low people, even though there's some high people, and many more people have high MOAA, so there's going to be a lot more. So you're going to miss some of them by just looking at low. Now, if you had the cutoff here, So that means you're going to including some of these high MOA. What you're going to do is ending up including a lot of as people are going to end up antisocial, low people who don't have the maltreatment. So you're going to end up with a society or a social arrangement where you're going to be monitoring people who don't end up being your problem. Because of that variation, there might get to be a pressure for people to understand which people are at the top end of this range and which people are at the bottom. In other words, we're going to stop classifying people into two types, low MOA and high MOA, and we're going to start to grade back into the variation of the within this variation. So it's a little bit like, if I can skip back a lot, it's a little bit like our first cut was low and high, but now we're actually going to try and understand this as well. So at first we were typological and now we're a little bit less typological. But of course, that's a much more difficult process to get the medical research establishment and the pharmaceutical industry interested in that second level variation. They're interested in, you know, what kind of drug can we market that would do this? And if people are labeled in that category, they're obviously, you know, they could end up like this, so let's give it to all the low ones. And again, that requires controlling the population so that the people who are actually in the low but weren't likely to be maltreated or weren't likely to be in the range of people who, even if maltreated, ended up high, might resist. And therefore, you've got to like silence their voices.
Why would they resist? Are there side effects? I mean, I just asked them because I couldn't quite understand.
You know, once you're it's like walking around with a yellow star on you. Once you're walking around, once the teachers know that you're a low MOA, they're going to be like, you're an incipient problem. You're not just a kid anymore. So their parents might say, I don't want my kid labeled like that. I don't want my kid being seen as a potential problem, when there's a good chance that they'll be at this other end. And also, I don't do any maltreatment in my family, so don't label my kid that way. And that's the same kind of thing that people would say. It's much easier to understand when we also think about this in terms of race, African-American kids and white kids. You know, when African-American kids get treated by teachers as if their IQ is going to be 15 points lower, it has a grave effect on their education.
Right, it's just before you compare this to putting fluoride in water, it's not exactly the same, but not allergic.
If there were a simple thing that could like shift this IQ test score for races up, like fluoride, then people probably wouldn't be so troubled by the heterogeneity. But there is a lot of behavior that where people get treated according to their group membership, and teachers do it. They don't do it completely oblivious to which of the black kids are, you know, are easier for them to teach, but they certainly come to classes with all sorts of ideas that are born of thinking about people in terms of types.
Right.
There are very few teachers who can avoid that. I mean, we have in education colleges these courses they call sociocultural perspectives and stuff like that to try to avoid that, but it's still very hard. What I want to do in this next example, and there aren't too many left, is to say, let's put aside MOAA, sometimes it's called the warrior gene or something, and let's actually think about personalized medicine. And in personalized, the prospect, the hope of personalized medicine, and it's a sort of huge intellectual industry now, is that treatments can be customized according to genotype. Now, I think all of us would quite like our treatment not just to be, you know, treated all the same as if we metabolize drugs the same way, one to the other, as if we're the same body weight and so on. So it appeals to us. You know, some of us are
You know, some people, the extreme thing is I'm allergic to penicillin, so I don't want penicillin. But there's gradations in that aren't quite as extreme. So you'd quite like to have medicine that is customized to your particular body. So personalized medicine is particularly focusing on conditions where they can find that given different genotypes that you're more susceptible to the drug or less susceptible to the drug. So here what I've said is, okay, here's the genetic condition A and B, and here's the environmental condition, or in this case, the medical treatment. But what often happens, well, and here you're going to see that there's overlap in these ranges. There's a range of responsiveness of people with genotype A to the treatment. And there are more people who are treated, let's say there are more people who are treated by the standard way. But there's still a range of ways. So some of those, there's not a huge overlap here, but in the people who have the genetic condition, actually there's no overlap in this graph at all, but I probably didn't choose the right, I just made up these graphs, I'll work on them. But the fact that there are some people who have the response that's not desired, who don't have the treatment, and some people who do have the treatment and don't have the response, says that there might be a second order interest in trying to work out which of us have this responsiveness or non-responsiveness. So the drug companies would be interested in a personalized medicine approach if they could identify a genetic condition and then a particular drug treatment, and they could prescribe the drug. Because you see that the Bs, the ones who have this condition, are further across to the right. So if you add up all the people in society, the drug companies could say, look, there's a big enough market for us and we can get this benefit on average to society. But to anyone down here, they might say, but it's going to come at a cost to me. So they might want to be learning whether they're going to be one of these people rather than one of these people. Let me give you a concrete example. In the United States, when men turn 50, the doctors tell them to take half a tab of aspirin every day. But and that protects you at some rate against stroke. I mean, it's not like it stops you having stroke, but it's a defense. Except what they've found is that some people are resistant to the effect of aspirin. So taking aspirin is just increasing their chances of having bleeding in their stomach tissues. So a person might want to say, a 50-year-old might want to say, look, I want to know whether I'm one of those people who is going to be, down at this end. And being treated, even though it's not helping me to resist stroke, and I'm actually increasing my damage. In practice, what happens is the doctors say, look, we know it works for some people, it doesn't work for others, but it's your choice, you choose. So they could have said, okay, we better develop this test and test you, but they've kind of like internalized the fact that those tests don't exist yet. They're expensive, and so they're not going to. And the medical associations haven't told them that, or the insurance companies haven't told them to do the tests. So they're like, that kind of, you choose whether to take the aspirin or not, is their form of controlling their population so that they can still treat us like types. They can still treat us as 50-year-old men for whom aspirin is on average beneficial. The problem is that for most pharmaceutical companies, the incentive to do the research and development is going to be on this first level. On average, is this an improvement for enough people that we can market the drugs? And there's not going to be very much incentive for the second level, which is the real personalized medicine stuff, when you really know you have the medicine customized to yourself. So ironically, personalized medicine, which seemed to appeal to the idea that we could all be treated as individuals, is going to go through a phase where we're being treated in terms of our group membership, 50-plus-year-old men or whatever. And it's a big question to me whether the social forces will act to move us beyond, or in what cases it will act to move us beyond that treating us like types. So the hype for personalized medicine like fast forwards to the to this ultimate future where we're all treated according to our individuality without actually paying attention to the transition process, which may get stalled halfway through. So heterogeneity is troubling. Here's one more example that taking us back to IQ test scores. There's a guy, Flynn, who lives in New Zealand now, James mm-hmm. Flynn, and he's known as the Flynn effect now because he was a political scientist, but when he started to look at the genes, IQ, and race debate, he discovered that from one generation to the next in Western societies, IQ test scores go up a standard deviation. And so they just keep moving where 100 is. So actually 100 was here a generation ago, and now it's up here. And lots of people have tried to explain. So there's variations here, of course, in the bell curve. Lots of people have tried to explain what it is that's doing this, and no one's much been able to find any consistent factor. It's not like improved diet or numbers of years of schooling or any of these broad brush factors that will shift you from here to here. So Flynn is like thinks that's a problem that needs paying attention to. What he also notices but keeps a little bit quieter, I mean, he's American by origin, and he was a civil rights activist in the early 60s. Also notices that the same situation is from African Americans to whites. There's a difference of 15 points in the average IQ, and it's been quite persistent. And attempts to explain this in terms of the income or the wealth of the different groups hasn't turned out to work very well. There's a few recent studies that have started to give a little bit of mileage, but mostly it's not very well explained. Now, people like who want to believe in genetic explanation of racial differences will say, look, here's this variation, and we know within a group, it's high, the heritability is high, they say 60 to 80%. There are people who criticize that, but let's say that's a consensus. So here's a character which is highly heritable. They think that therefore means that it's caused by genes. They're not troubled by the underlying heterogeneity issue. And they say, and this one's also caused by genes. So given that we haven't been able to find an environmental factor, isn't it at least plausible that there could be genetic factors in this difference? So that's Arthur Jensen's two-part argument. But Flynn's underlying agenda, though he doesn't make it public all that often, is you could use that same logic to say, okay, IQ test scores are highly heritable a generation ago, they're highly heritable now. No simple environmental or social factors explain the difference. Therefore, there must be a genetic difference between one generation, or it's plausible that there's a genetic difference between one generation and the next. But we know there's not a genetic difference between one generation and the next. So there must be a problem with the argument used there. So whatever the logic is, it must be wrong here too. There's got to be a more complicated explanation that pays attention to the way many different factors work together with the variation to move you over time. I'm not going to try to give you Flynn eventually teamed up with an economist called Dickens. I'm not going to give you their explanation, but I just wanted to introduce this example as a place where people are trying to, many people are still trying to say, look, there's this persistent difference, all your social programs haven't worked, therefore it's plausible, it's genetic, and stop denying it, stop being anti-genetics, and tell you, first, there's the issue of underlying heterogeneity, and then there's this other issue of when you try to explain the shift from one mean to the next in terms of a factor, you end up with these logical problems in your argument. This was another graph that was supposed to just be a cutout, but I can do it, and I can still finish in
some time, unknown time. This bottom thing, this top thing is like trying to schematize how testing for PKU, for newborns, for phenylketonuria became routine from the 1960s in the United States to the 1980s. This bottom one, I don't know why it's got this little thing on the bottom. This bottom one is trying to say what happens over a lifetime. So you don't even have to look at the details, but here's the person's PKU condition, the diagnostic and care, the social support, and the wider social context. PKU is used as a poster child of genetics. It's used to say, look, we get to diagnose these people, a genetic condition, single locus, and then we can do something about it. So isn't genetics great? Now, there are not many cases like PKU where diagnosis leads to a treatment that can... in PKU, if you don't have a treatment, which is a very specialized, bland diet, you end up very severely retarded very quickly by, you know, 1 or 2 years old. So here's a treatment that lets these people live to mature age. So that seems good. There aren't many cases like this, but even if this is used as a paradigm for what the Human Genome Project was going to be able to reveal and so on, what happens when you actually look at what happens to those kids is there's a lot more what I call intersecting processes. You know, the diet is hard to maintain, and it depends on your religious and ethnic identity, whether how much people try to subvert the diet, how much they support you, whether the diet is subsidized after 5 years old in the United States by insurance companies. It's an issue of struggle from one place to the next, whether your peer groups are supporting you. It turns out even with the diet, there's a lower IQ and some of the other deficits. And it also turns out that if women who have PKU don't keep up with their diet and then they have kids, these kids have had higher levels of phenylalanine in the uterus, and their brains are messed up. And it's not a genetic condition. It's not something you can just change their diet and fix up. So there's a secondary phenomenon that never existed before. It's called maternal PKU. So this simple genetic thing, you got the gene, simple genetic story, which I have been guilty of using in the past, turns out in practice to have many different intersection of different strands of wider social context and immediate social context and so on. And in each of those strands, there's a lot of heterogeneity about how, depending on your religious and ethnic identity, how you deal with them, depending on whether you're in Canada or United States, whether you've got the subsidies and so on. So again, even the simple genetic stories, once you start to look through this lens of heterogeneity, start to open up in interesting new ways. So that there are many different places where someone, I mentioned the word participation, where someone could decide to try to do something. They could be activists for universal health insurance in the United States, or even for this diet to be kept as a something which is subsidized by the state. They could be, a friend of mine works in summer camps for kids with PKU. They've never met each other, but by getting together in a summer camp, they start to see themselves in a different way. Rather than the oddball amongst their friends, they're now in an identifiable group, and et cetera, et cetera. There are many places where someone could participate in this complexity, where there's not many ways to participate when you just say, PKU, diagnose, give the diet, and that's the story. And I'm going to skip this last case. So, troubled by heterogeneity. Did I trouble the theoretical biologists here, the philosophers of science, and so on? In each case, it's a question. You can be answering it for yourself or pursue it in the discussion. But my idea is that there are many cases in theoretical biology where people are doing this typological stuff, or their analyses would differ if they paid attention to unequal units that are in dynamic interactions. You know, the theoretical ecologist in me learned very early that if you treat, you know, if you're modeling fish in a reservoir and you treat them as if they're just a population of equal size individuals, you get qualitatively different results from if you start off with a range of sizes of fish
and depending on the bigger ones are more able to get resources, at least in good times, than the small ones, and you end up not just with a different overall range of the fish, you end up with a different overall biomass. So the models turn out to be qualitatively misplaced by not paying attention to heterogeneity. Philosophers of science, I think, those who look at the twin studies debates, heritability, should be paying attention to this issue, but then they should perhaps think about all sorts of cases they make, all sorts of reasoning they make without paying attention to variation and heterogeneity in their, you know, the typical philosopher argument will be able to be not more summarized like the two dots without the variation around them, but, you know, that's an overstatement. But I also think the historians and sociologists of science have many issues here about why people haven't been troubled by heterogeneity, and the policy, life sciences have stuff to research, and the policymakers do too. So my overall thesis, which I said halfway through the talk and in the abstract, is summarized in this last slide, which is the research and application of knowledge, and the application of knowledge that results from the research is not troubled by variation, particularity, and heterogeneity to the extent that populations are well controlled. That control can be established and maintained through considerable effort or social infrastructure, which invites more attention to possibilities of participation and allowing us to pay attention back to these variations, particularity and heterogeneity, or even into the way we apply the results. And these little things here are supposed to be like springs. They're supposed to say there are things in tension, factors that pull you out to controlling populations versus possibilities of many points of participation, being troubled by heterogeneity versus being untroubled by, versus paying more attention. Okay, thanks. That is it.
Before we start the discussion, I would just like to say that we're going to the Italian restaurant nearby, which, if you don't know, is very good, and it's on the house, on the PLI, so all you're all invited, and we can continue the discussion
if there is
there,
any.
Of course. But, yes, please.
So, I was wondering if I couldn't quite figure out whether what you presented here you see as technical problems or fundamental problems, and I'll try to explain what I'm saying. So, here, for example, with the little springs, you say, you know, either you're not troubled by heterogeneity, and then you want to better control populations, or you are troubled by heterogeneity, and then you will. That invites more attention to participation. That's how I understand sort of this last slide. And I'm just wondering if it's a... So first of all, if it's really that much of an either-or situation, is it not possible to... Because in the slide before that, you wrote life scientist question mark, and I was wondering, yes, what should life scientists or just working scientists do with what you're saying about heterogeneity? Because it seems that some of the things you're saying, okay, so we got stuck at the first order and we didn't go to check, you know, what produces a certain type of bell curve, but that just seems to me to be an invitation to delve even more deeply and try to figure out more precisely, not so much totally abandon the genetic.
So let me take the question. This slide is saying two things. One is, were you here, if there are any life scientists, troubled by the cases of heterogeneity? But it's also saying, you know, it's a question about how much life scientists are troubled by heterogeneity. And my sort of working hypothesis is that they are not troubled to the extent that they're working with populations that can be well controlled. And rather than just leaving it that as a technical issue, it's now saying, so what does it mean sociologically and also, you know, in terms of the politics and policy for populations to be controlled? Populations don't tend to be as well controlled as the idea would like.
You know, you have, I don't know if you know the work of James Scott, Seeing Like a State. There's always like resistance to the grand schemes, the controls of populations. So what I'm saying is that I can enter into a technical problem, but I'm not going, the type of thinker I am is not going to stop there. I'm not going to say, oh, those scientists are wrong, they're doing the wrong thing. I'm going to ask, why are they doing what they're doing? Why have they not been troubled by heterogeneity? Having established that heterogeneity is potentially troubling, even if it's just a technical issue, I now have to ask, why aren't they troubled? Sometimes people say the answer is, well, they haven't thought about it. I'm never quite satisfied with that. My experience as a scientist, my experience trying to get scientists to pay attention to their, not just to what they're studying, but to the situations in which they study, says that scientists are a lot more aware of those conditions, their social situatedness, than the rhetoric in their papers. So I'm doing, you know, something that goes in a circle from the science to looking at the social context to looking back at. If we understand the social context, we'll end up being able to ask some more scientific questions. So the second part of your, a little part of your question was saying, are you just saying you've got this bell curve, so you need to look at that? Well, what I'm saying is that, first of all, you have to be aware that this is an issue. You know that graph I did with the sort of the webs of things down? If you're not thinking those ways, you'll end up, well, there's a lot of people end up saying, what are you talking about? You know, this is genetic variation. When it's not genetic, it's not variation of genes in the heritability studies, it's variation. You know, heritability is about the average for the trait for a defined population over the range of measured populations compared with the overall variation in that trait. It's some, you know, very long-winded term. And because they use the same word genetic, the genetic variation in genes, they haven't done the extra thinking. So I'm trying to sort of create some awareness. But then I'm also trying to say, once you're aware that this is an issue, there's a cost to not being aware of it. That might be a cost to your research productivity too. So if you, most people doing genomic analysis on a trait will say, well, we choose our traits, we choose as traits to study those that have high heritability. So they're good candidates. Even though that kind of heritability studies, they're no longer concentrating on. They maybe don't even have the skills for it, but they know someone's done it. You know, schizophrenia has high concordance and so on. They'll have done that. So that kind of gives them the license to do this stuff. But if they paid attention to the possibility of underlying heterogeneity, two things would happen. One is they might say, it might not work. It might be different genes for these, and different environment factors go together for this person's schizophrenia from this person's. Do I really want to invest 3 years of grant, you know, and do all these grants to do that when I've got that uncertainty about their outcomes? The second thing that might happen is started to happen this year is that people are saying the genome-wide association studies haven't really proved to give us very clear results. What's happened? And they say, well, there are lots of little genes with the little effects. And other people are saying, we're looking for the wrong thing. We should be looking for the rare genes that have a big effect. That's like the PKUs, but not quite as striking as PKUs. So they're trying to reorient their study. But I think, and some of them are saying, we couldn't have known in advance that this would have such a low outcome, low yield. But I'm saying, well, actually, if you'd paid attention to underlying heterogeneity, you would have at least had a worry that it wasn't going to come out very far. So you might have at least, some of the scientists might have at least talked about it and perhaps developed a different research program. So technical, sociological, I don't make distinctions in the end.
Yeah, let me try and speak as a life scientist. And a life scientist might respond to say, it's not quite right that we are deeply troubled by heterogeneity. And it's all very well for you to come and say that we should consider heterogeneity, but in most cases heterogeneity is highly complex, right? And what we have with for controlling populations and the various methods is a way of dealing with that and getting some kind of information out of the world. And it's in fact our analytic method to begin to deal with complexity. And then of course we try and apply the method at deeper and deeper levels to try and build up more information. But of course this is our entry point. And that getting actually at the start into heterogeneity is just going to confuse us and lead us nowhere.
Yeah, that was my sort of counsel of, you know, like, yeah, you want this ideal world where God can see behind all the surfaces. What I want to say on the spot is that that methodological move becomes something people start to see the world that way, and so they're not paying attention to what's needed to make the methodology work. So quantitative genetics is this field where that for most of its history, that can still be done without really knowing anything about any genes. And for most of its history was. So it's just an analysis of the trait variation, and because some relatives are more closely related to each other, they call it genetics. Now, quantitative genetics is used to do selection experiments to predict the results of selection. This is artificial selection. And so those heuristics get used by, in the lab, they get used by agricultural breeders. And the agricultural breeders find that they don't get the improvements they thought. And so if they had been paying attention to underlying heterogeneity, they'd have a better way of thinking about it than just plow on, throw away those other things. So they'd have a different way of thinking about it. But what I find happens when people get used to in the population genetics world, where they're doing these lab experiments about selection, is they start to think about natural selection that way too. So although natural selection is always in this world of heterogeneity, the way people think about it is as if it's in this world of selection, which can, if you control the populations well enough, be untroubled by heterogeneity. And so they're limiting their ability to actually deal with the world that they want to deal with. That's part of my response. So it's not a simple move. And I think in some ways, these biomedical cases puts a little bit of a maybe ethical edge on it by saying, well, maybe dealing with your, worms or something, you don't have to be too worried. It's just a methodology. You've got to get some results. You've got to get statistical significance. So what is statistical significance? But a study of whether typological study, types versus the variation. You've got to do that. That's no harm to the world. But by paying attention to where it does harm people, or you do overlook medically, biomedically significant things, it puts a bit of an edge and maybe says, maybe we should go back and think about whether we're losing something. Not our ethical commitment to earthworms, but something. Please.
Yes, you said that historians of science should be troubled, and I would be interested if you could give me a timeline saying, indicating what fields of research there might be. I mean, what time are you thinking about? Are you thinking about, your population control? So you're thinking about the coming of statistics into medicine? Are you thinking earlier that heterogeneity? Disappeared from science.
Okay, so my hope is that I've introduced one historical problem, and that might then people might then be able to project it into other problems. But the first problem obviously is why has this how has this field developed for 90 years or 100 years? Without paying attention to underlying heterogeneity, and that's an issue of looking a bit deeply, finding out whether someone did, but then they, didn't get tenure, or got frustrated, or there wasn't anything they could do with it, or they didn't have an audience, or whatever things you find in history. That's also a question for philosophers too, what do you, if you came to agree that my little, that underlying heterogeneity changes the way we think about heritability studies, you know, I'm not saying I've convinced you all, but if you did come to be convinced, you'd have a problem as philosophers of saying, what do I do when I think the scientists have missed something for 90 years or 100 years? And it's not a simple question to look at, because usually what you do is you think, I must be wrong, I better shut up because I'll make a fool of myself. But you could, but you've got, you know, philosophy isn't that well, it tries to be very normative about scientific method, but it's not very well positioned to try to change scientists about these things. But that's a digression. I just wanted to go back to other historical problems. So I actually think the fact that statistics is found, the basic method of statistics, a t-test, is basically a typological thing, is a great irony, because statistics was supposed to be the embracing our knowledge of human variation. But the method actually says variation is this thing that just allows us to tell whether the types are really different or not. And then, so there's this, I think once you start to look at the way people use statistics to control populations or try to control them or fantasize about controlling them, there's a lot of historical problems there, a lot of historical issues. And it just gives you the technical issue then gives you a little bit of an extra edge, not the only edge. Naomi wants to add something, though.
No, I was just wondering, so you said that science and philosophy of science have ignored this problem for the past 90 years, and just one title springs to mind, which is Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man, and that's about IQ testing, and he definitely had tenure. I mean, I'm just wondering if that is an accurate depiction of how scientists deal with that problem. Again, I don't want to, I mean, it just seems that there is, I agree, it's problematic to get an article published in Science on Nature if it's too complex and if you don't have nice results to show after you've explained, or before actually you explained the statistical methods you use. But I'm not entirely sure. I'm just trying to figure out what is your suggestion about noticing underlying heterogeneity more. I mean, clearly in the social sciences, this has been, it's known that how you treat children will have an effect on their functioning as adults, and there are many researchers about that. And so I'm just wondering.
So look, the thing that has been ignored for 90 years is this issue about underlying heterogeneity in twin studies. So Stephen Jay Gould didn't critique IQ studies on those terms. He could understand how to do factor analysis, which is a generalization, a multivariate generalization of t-tests and so on. So he could work out how to do that and how to, you know, comment on that and vary max rotations and so on. But he didn't actually notice this thing about the way genetic was used and start to pay attention to the underlying heterogeneity. Okay, but in a larger field, partly why I've got these diagrams, you said they're not so much oppositions. A spring to me is something that if you push it together, it'll resist you. If you pull it apart, it'll resist you. So that's my image here. It's not an image of a separation. So I think they are in tension in those ways. And so if you read, I mentioned it the other day, if you read the books that they write in English about child development, if you have time when you bring up your kid to read them, they'll tell you that, it's Leach, Spock, and Brazelton. They'll tell you that children at 6 months do this, at 8 months do this, and so on. So there's this thing. But then Brazelton, I think, will also tell you, but it's six, maybe they start at 4 months and go to 8 months. So they'll tell you about a variation. But they won't tell you about the multiple routes to something like walking. You know, kids end up walking, but there are some kids never crawl and they end up walking. So there are obviously multiple routes in development, and in social development even more so. And so their books are, and if you talk to them, of course they would be aware of variation. As a doctor, they would, someone would come in and say, look, my child's not walking yet. And that's, don't worry, if it's not walking by 26 months maybe, but it's fine. It's, so they understand variation. But they, their method, because they were just trying to be able to give good advice to people, was more like, here's the advice about what you'd expect and here's the range. It wasn't digging deep into the multiple ways people get to walk or the multiple ways people get to talk or something like that. So if there's an area that hasn't been explored that, that would be interesting, because I bet you there are people who've that I just don't know of who've not been at Brazelton, not been so high profile, and have started to explore that or be troubled by it, and they could get sort of exhumed by historians, and that would then be interesting to see what happened to their careers, to their advice they gave, and so on.
Yes. I might have a couple of comments. The first one goes back a couple. I do obviously think that heterogeneity is something we really need to look at, but like you were saying, I think it's looking at just one thing really helps us think. Expecting you to put our feet into the water. Often it's far too complex of an issue, and that happens everywhere in human thought and human learning, where we purposefully get rid of several factors in order to start a topic. Of a very common example is shooting a gun. People are very unable to shoot at first, and they don't know how to do it, and so what they do is they lock out all the degrees of freedom to make it easier on themselves, to try to just control one thing. And so when we run into a very complex topic, that's what we do, is we lock out as much as we can to just get to that one thing, and then later on we can delve into the small variations between it. And I think it's in places where we actually do have impact on people, we do. I think it's a little bit unfair to say that, for your example of doctors, that we just have one treatment and we give that. It's typically where you have a study, or the teaching is that when this happens, you give someone this. When someone turns 50, you give them half a tablet of aspirin. But when you actually go down, because that's very easy to give a broad message to a large group of people, and then when you go to the individual level, you will get the doctor saying, well, okay, I know you, and I know you have a very sensitive stomach, and so make sure you come back next week or the week after that, and we'll run these tests on you, or I know you and you need a little bit more, you need a little bit less. And the doctors do that variation based on people's heterogeneity when it's something that matters, when it has direct consequences on, for example, someone's health. But then on things where it doesn't, so for example, we're doing research on whatever, then we just look for the very big issue, and later on, if we have time, go for the 20 different factors that have very, very small impact, but can add up to a lot. And then the second thing was, I think heterogeneity is being looked at in a lot of issues, such as human development. I know that when I was teaching it, we talked a lot about how there are different researchers looking at, for example, if you have a softer floor or a harder floor, often that will affect how the baby develops. A very soft floor, sometimes babies will roll like a pencil, whereas hard floors, it hurts them, so they don't. Sometimes they scoot on their butt before and then get up to walk. Sometimes they go backwards, and they do look at all these different things. And there's lots of research being done on the variation in development. People are saying if we carry the child more, then child walks later, or these cultures help assist the child, these kids who work with different sizes pins will develop later or earlier with that. So I definitely agree that it should be looked at. I just think it's being looked at more than you give it credit for. And there are some benefits to not looking at it at first and then coming back to it later.
So
that was a bit rambling. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, I talked about Brazelton, Leach, and Spock because they're the books. I didn't talk about the researchers on human development, but I It's taken a bit of a struggle, not just to look at the kind of variation you're looking at, but you know, there are people, it's a woman at Brown, Garcia, who's looked at the standard things she learned as a developmental psychologist in terms of race and gender. So it's been a bit of a struggle, and people are, but you know, she's now been published reviews 20 years ago on this, so clearly it's been looked at. But this the first thing you brought up is like a standard thing that people will trot out as if that's really what goes on in decision making, that people just, it's just a heuristic thing, you've got to start simple and add. Well, the problem is that one is that when people use a method for long enough, they start to see the world that way, and the things they can see are shaped by that method. So, for example, Francis Galton only collected information about the what we would now call offspring parent or relative correlations. He early on he said, look, I'm just looking at genius, which doesn't mean quite the same thing as we'd use it now, but so these are characters that can't be that, you know, they're too extreme to be affected by schooling, so I'm not going to look at the environment. So he proceeded then to look at things like whether you got in the crew of rowing at Oxford, which I don't think is genius, but he didn't collect any data on environment, so all he could get out from his method was the things we would now call, you know, heritability, the genetic stuff. And someone called, years ago, someone called Del Himes, who was an anthropologist, a linguist who was very anthropologically aware, you know, what actually people use language, said about Chomsky's work and the Chomskins, that what they did was, you know, sampling is fine, you know, taking a small group to try to get some idea about what the large is like. But what these people have done is simpling. Simpling is that they've cut out what they should never cut out, and then they then start to say, "Oh, and look what, look at our progress. We've now they add back things that, in Del Himes' word, they never should have left out." So you might say they never would have got anywhere. But you've got a whole field of people who believe at root, people's language. There are even people, Chomsky himself, who defines language as that thing which corresponds to generative grammar. The other stuff is just messy something or other else. You know, Chomskyans in that context are Aristotelian. I'll get back to Aristotle in just a second. So there's a sense in which you do it, you build up a way of dealing with subjects, whatever your field is, and you start to, it reproduces itself. But in order to do that, I think if you have my sort of sociological sort of input, you'd always be asking yourself, okay, to do that, we're controlling populations, and what is implied in terms of what effort do we have to do, and what is that, how does that control affect the way we apply that knowledge? And because in some senses, genetic biotechnology works not to the extent they really find out how genes work, but to the extent they're able to then engineer the conditions so that genes keep working the same way that they did in their test tubes. Well, it always goes together. You never get a simple... Engineering is always about... It's not about finding out where the real world, it's about finding out something about the world that you can build some equipment around to reproduce and make the world keep acting that way. So if you want to keep doing that engineering, it may be fine to use that heuristic, but it's never just simply using the heuristic because the world's complex. It's always got some other extensions of this theme about populations being well controlled. And the essentialism is just, to me, Aristotelian essentialism is about that there's a pathway of development, and what the deviation from it is noise. And that's a particular view of the world that has a lot of ramifications and reinforcements, you know, that are worth. But to me, I want to trouble people who aren't troubled by it, and I want to trouble them more, and it ought to be more troubling. So there's a lot of statements in there, normative,
activist, whatever.
I suggest that.
Okay.
I mean, can you join us for dinner?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, then I suggest we can go on.
Hungry.
Oh,
I see.